This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. It may only be the last day of February, but 2008 has already been a busy year for militant animal rights activists. These protesters used tactics like smear campaigns, vandalism, and sometimes violence to try and stop researchers from experimenting on animals in the lab. They appear to be responsible for a fire at a UCLA scientist's home 3 weeks ago, and there are allegations activists were involved in another attack on a West Coast researcher's home just last weekend. Overseas in Europe, businesses associated with animal research are reporting an increase in vandalism. Today on Science Friday, we're exploring the issue of animal rights and research ethics. If you'd like to join us, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my first guest this hour. Michael Kahn is Associate Director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center. He is also co-author with James Parker of the forthcoming book, The Animal Research War, from Palgrave Macmillan, in which he discusses the rise of the militant animal rights movement. He joins us from Portland. Welcome.
Hello, Joe, and thanks very much for featuring this important topic.
Well, thank you for joining us. And frankly, you know, as someone who is bringing this up, you know, scientists seem to like to have a low profile about this. And in fact, in your book, you talk about the silent war. Can you tell me more about what you mean about when you say that, silent war?
Well, the war against animal researchers is a very real and, as you pointed out, very violent war, but all but invisible in the media. And that was one of the reasons that Jim Parker and I wrote this book. We'd like to place this on the public agenda. We'd like the public to understand that there are researchers who are now walking away from productive careers because they fear for their family's well-being. Extremist groups are having a strangling effect on a lot of drug development. The book talks about the battles, the spies, and the casualties in the animal research war, but our fear that if the extremists win, the real losers will be the public, all the people struggling with disease.
But there's always a double-edged sword here, because on the one hand, you can certainly point to examples of research that's benefited humans and the human health. But there's certainly research that has also gone nowhere and in retrospect anyway, caused unnecessary suffering from animals. And you sometimes wonder, well, if people really knew the whole story, maybe they wouldn't. They'd say, on balance, you know, we don't want the benefits because the costs are too great. What do you say to that?
Well, I think every once in a while you hear about something that's gone wrong, a bad scenario, and just for the moment, because as often as not, we don't really know what happened. Let's assume that some of these scenarios are true. So what you're really saying then is because people die in car accidents, we shouldn't drive cars. Just because there are occasional problems, it does not mean you should turn off a pipeline that has unquestionably improved the circumstances, not only of people, but of animals as well. We live in a wonderful time. The happy news is that a lot of young people you talk to will think the Iron Lung is a rock group. Mm-hmm. They won't remember polio. They won't remember smallpox. Those are some of the major triumphs of animal research. They affect virtually everybody's life. Research, as you point out, is a trade-off. In order to learn more how to help humans, we engage in animal experimentation. But this experimentation is governed by strict rules and regulations put on our plate by the federal government. There is very little pain or suffering in animal research.
You know, you're at the Oregon National Primate Research Center, and over the years I've had occasion to do stories that involve your institution, and every time I call, there's a great trepidation about what's the media going to say if they come here. And I have to feel a lot of convincing that I'm not coming in to do an expose of some sort. I'm just interested in the science, although I suppose if there were an expose to be done, I'd want to do that too. But the point is, it seems to me there's a defensive quality on the part of scientists as well, not just against because it may be justifiably, but certainly it's sometimes hard to get in the door to hear the story of what the benefits are.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. Some of them are technical. Because our animals are susceptible to human tuberculosis, we require anyone who enters the facilities to have proof of not being tuberculin positive. Beyond that, just interacting with the animals requires some training. It's not a good idea, and it's very stressful for animals. When you stare at them, it upsets them. It upsets animals when there are new people around them. They wonder what's going on. But one of our real problems has to do with the media. In an effort to create balanced newscasts, media frequently give individuals with extremist views, people who make outlandish and often untrue accusations, the same platform and the same airtime as researchers. The public presumes that the truth is somewhere in between. The media should strive to find out the truth and report that.
And so can you cite an example of where a claim by an animal rights group has been given equal weight with a scientifically valid point of view?
Absolutely. One of the things that drew my attention to writing this book to begin with came from a personal experience when I went on a trip to the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast now. And what happened was an animal extremist learned that I was going to be taking that trip. And this is an individual who'd said that the killing of animal researchers is warranted in order to stop animal research. He posted that on his listserv, and I was followed around for about 2.5 days. They tried to meet me at the airport. They made wild accusations to the media, which were reported by the media. I was in a very defensive mode trying to address them, when in fact they were made up from whole cloth, and I ended up being on the same platform as individuals who were literally making up stories. At the time, we were not using monkeys at all, in fact. And at that time, I hadn't even used rats in several years. But they made all kinds of outlandish claims, put up billboards at the university where I was, and used public access laws in that state to attend meetings, to shout at me. And it really got us nowhere.
Okay, let's take a call right now, because this is obviously a very contentious issue, but let's go now to the phones and talk to Justin in Vernon, Connecticut. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Joe.
You bet.
I think it's kind of undeniable that there's this growing body of research showing that grandiose claims about, you know, the predictive value and contribution of animal experiments to human health are completely unfounded, and that the overwhelming majority of all animal experiments have no utility at all for human health.
So wait a minute. That's a pretty broad statement. Can you cite a scientific paper or
there is an article that came out in this month's Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. It's written by Robert Matthews.
Okay.
And he makes these claims exactly. And
well,
the successes that have come from animal experiments are nothing more than anecdotal, much like, I would suggest, the claims that Mr. Kahn is making about the existence of violence in the animal rights movement.
Okay. Let's ask first Mr. Kahn, Dr. Kahn, if he knows about this article and the proceedings of the Royal Society.
I do not, but there's many, many examples in the literature suggesting just the otherwise to be true. I mean, let's face it.
Right.
Even humans are not perfect models for other humans. Animals are not perfect models for humans, but there is one classic study that has been off-cited in the literature, and it was done by Harry Olson and colleagues. And what they did was they brought together the results from 12 different international pharmaceutical companies, and they looked at the predictivity of animal tests in human toxicity. The overall conclusion from 150 randomly selected compounds and 221 human toxicity events was that the animal model had significant predictive power to detect most, but not all, areas of human toxicity. So there is a big advantage. If you look at the history,
the FDA also reports that 95% of drugs that are tested in animals fail in human clinical trials because they can't predict the side effects of the drugs in animals that are going to result in human beings.
Justin, hold on a second, and Dr. Kahn, hold on a second. We may be able to cut through this because I have another guest who's on the line, and he's actually from the UK, and I'm going to bring him on now. Jonathan Wolfe is a member of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, and he's a professor and department head in philosophy at University College London. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wolfe.
I'll say good evening because it's evening my time.
Well, fine. That's good. We'll accept that. We're familiar with time change here.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've been hearing what we were just talking about, but there was allegedly or apparently an article in, Justin, which journal?
The Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine.
Journal of the Royal Society.
Matthews.
By Matthews, talking about the lack of predictive value of animal research. Did you see that article by any chance?
I didn't see that one. I'm familiar with those sorts of claims, yeah.
And what do you make of them in general?
Well, I'm a philosopher, not a scientist, and so I have to leave it to the scientists to decide whether the studies are predictive. But in the report we did for the Nuffield Council, we thought it was very important to make a distinction between the scientific questions and the moral questions, because even if it is true that we learn a lot from animal experiments, it doesn't follow from that that they're morally acceptable. And so we do have to take the ethical question separately from the scientific question.
Okay. So now I want to go back, Justin, if you'll indulge me for a second, to Dr. Khan, because it does seem as if is there a question? I would never have doubted the validity of animals in research based on, 25 years of science reporting, but do you have any doubts at all?
Our obligation to animals, Joe, is that they don't suffer or feel pain. Our obligation to people is that we respect people's rights to be self-directing within the context of society. There's been a great deal of discussion about the morality of doing research, and I was actually, I received a great deal of insight from comments made by the Dalai Lama when he addressed the neuroscience meeting in, I think it was 2005. He said, "I encourage the minimum use of experiments on animals. The absolute minimum of pain, only perform highly necessary experiments with as little pain as possible. If it must be done and that is your path, it is compassionate to kill out of necessity, but only with empathy."
Okay.
I think that's extremely telling, and I think it addresses something that we all embrace in animal research, and that is the three R's, reduction, refinement, and replacement.
Okay, Dr. Khan, I'm going to have to cut you off there because we have to take a short break. Justin, thank you very much for starting this topic. We will not stop here. And do stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about animal research. My guests are Michael Khan. He's the Associate Director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center and the co-author of the new book, The Animal Research War. And Jonathan Wolfe has just joined us. He's a philosophy professor at University of College London who helped write a 2005 bioethics report on animal experimentation. And I want to come back to those three R's that you were mentioning, Dr. Khan, but I just want to belabor Justin's point for one more second, which is the use of animals scientifically valid? Because as Dr. Wolf said, there's a moral question that has to be dealt with, but if you're not even getting useful information from animals, which I never knew was even being seriously suggested, but if you're not, then why bother in the first place? So do you accept the premise that animals are not valuable as predictors for behavior of drugs and what have you and understanding human disease?
Animals are very valuable, but they're not perfect predictors. In fact, anyone watching the news recently will know that drug trials for cough medicine that was tested in adults failed to provide accurate data for children. The drug industry has known for years that even things like gender, age, and the ethnic background of test subjects may result in data that's only reliable for that demographic. In the same way, one could certainly argue that fish are not very good models for human hearing aids. But in point of fact, the proof is in the pudding. The majority of the cures that have come out in the last century has come as the direct result of animal research. Diabetes was first discovered in dogs, and it was animal studies that helped us understand the mechanism by which diabetes occurs.
So coming back to you, Jonathan Wolfe, and the report that you wrote, I presume that it starts with the premise, at least, that there is some value in using animals research, else why bother with coming up with a report to discuss the appropriate use of animals in research?
It's certainly a question we had to consider because we took evidence from the public, and we got quite a few letters arguing exactly the point that Justin made before, that there's no predictive power, And indeed, some people argued that animal research had held up medical research, because if we hadn't been wasting our time experimenting on animals, we would have done other things which were much more valuable. So we had to consider this, and in fact, our view in the end, not my view because I didn't write that part, but the view of the committee was very similar to Dr. Kahn's view, that there are many mistakes, but there are also many benefits as well.
Not your view.
Well, it's not... I didn't have a view because I'm not competent to assess a scientific...
Okay, that's fine. That's a perfectly reasonable point of view. All right, let's take another call now, and let's go to Najib in Oklahoma City, I guess, Oklahoma. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Very, very interesting subject. I'm a professional scientist, and I work for a public university here in Oklahoma, and I'm also a member of a committee at the university, which is called the Animal Use Committee. And I was wondering if I could bring the discussion to a more pragmatic point, which is that the federal government mandates that such committees exist on all institutions where animal research is conducted. And this committee is charged with the mission of ensuring that animals are used humanely. And one of the things that we have on our research protocols, the three R's that have been mentioned in the discussion, the first one is replace. And one of the questions we ask all our researchers to do is to ask them, have you considered alternatives to animal use? In other words, have you considered replacing the animals that you're requesting for the kind of work that you're doing and the kind of hypothesis that you're positing? And thank you. I'll get your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rajiv. What about that, Dr. Kahn?
Well, one of the things that we learned when we were writing the book that surprised us is about half of the American population does not realize that animal research is regulated. Not only is it regulated very, very strictly by the Animal Welfare Act in the United States, but there are comparable laws in the UK and other parts of the world as well. These laws give the USDA the ability to come in and inspect our facility, and inspect they do. The USDA shows up at random times during the year, typically about twice a year. Last year it happened to have been three times a year. And they show up at random times. Everyone stops what they're doing. They can open any door. They can look in any closet. They look to make sure that we don't have any Tylenol that's 2 weeks beyond expiration date. If we do, we get cited. They can also shut us down. They can also levy very heavy fines, and they've done that at institutions in the past when they're out of compliance.
So, Dr. Wolf, Jonathan Wolf, in the UK, are there similar protections or more stringent, or do you know the differences between the US and the UK?
Well, we believe that we are the most stringent country for regulations. Perhaps every country thinks that, but we have very similar regulations to the ones just described.
And, but the regulations presuppose, again, that any research is acceptable and that some pain is acceptable, or disease induction, because the benefit is there. So you're still starting with some level of use that some people will object to.
Well, that's true. And we do, in our regulations, have a committee that performs a type of cost-benefit analysis, which they... used to grant a license. And so if you're applying for a license, you have to show that there is going to be a medical benefit for human health or animal health. And the committee has to be convinced that the benefits do outweigh the costs. But, you know, the problem with any cost-benefit analysis is when you have a situation where the benefits go to one group and all the costs fall on another. And that really is what is morally problematic to many people, that even though many animal experimentations are done for animals, they're not done for the animals who are in the experiments.
Yeah.
And these will suffer something, maybe not very much pain, but they will die prematurely. And that is a concern to some people, many people, I think.
Let's take another call now and go to Angie in Chicago, Illinois. Angie, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi. I'm a research scientist, and I happen to have a love of animals. I have many animals at home, and actually studied animal sciences in school, and ended up in a human research lab because of the more availability of jobs. But I guess, so that's just my background, but I guess I wanted, my comment was, or question, I understand that you call animal rights activists terrorists and militant, but it kind of sounds biased to me. You're coming off saying he's militant animal rights activist instead of saying he's animal rights activist, which some of them, you know, do, you know, non-justifiable actions. But there are people out there, like I feel, you know, a lot of empathy and feeling for the animals that we use in our lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to be called a militant person because I have I feel.
Well,
I think
you're making a fair point. I think as I hear it, and I'll let Michael Kahn speak to this, but we're making a distinction here between people who hold strong beliefs and would prefer, I think even in your book, Michael Kahn, there's a card that some people are, you know, you offer to people who say, I don't want to benefit from animal research, I don't want to take part in it, I don't want my research dollars to go for it, so I'm signing this card, you know, saying don't do anything beneficial for me that's based on animal research. Then we make a distinction between people who have a moral objection and people who take that moral objection and use it to justify violent threats against researchers. At least that's how I would see it, Michael Kahn. Maybe I didn't characterize it properly.
Well, when I call people extremists, I'm talking about individuals who believe in no leather, no pets, and no medical research. And those views are very extreme compared to most of the public. It is absolutely okay for you or anyone to disagree with me, to publicly discuss your views, to lobby your congressman, to try to change the law. What is not okay is to put a bomb at my doorstep or menace my family. People living in a civilized society can all agree that firebombing homes and threatening children is not part of the acceptable process of bringing about political change. In a democracy, fear and intimidation cannot be allowed to play a part in changing the hearts and minds of people.
Sure, but I think it's important that when we're on a national media like this that we don't give people that are really fighting for animal rights, maybe in an honest way, in a good way, that we don't give them a bad name, too.
Right. So you're saying don't tar people with a broad brushstroke, that there's nuance in this debate. And I appreciate you bringing that point up. I think now we've been talking some about alternatives to animals and research, and we have another guest this hour who can speak directly to that question. William Stokes is the director of the National Interagency Center for the Evaluation of Alternative Toxicological Methods, a committee organized by the NI National Institutes of Health that helps look at using non-animal alternatives in the lab. Welcome to the program, Dr. Stokes.
Thank you very much, Joe.
So,
appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Good. So tell me, what is this new program? How will it replace animals that are currently being used in research?
Well, we have a interagency committee that involves all of the federal agencies that are responsible for safeguarding the public health and safety of both animals and people and the environment. We work together to review proposed new alternative methods, and I just want to emphasize that those alternative methods are ones that reduce the number of animals used for a procedure or replace the animals with a non-animal approach, or refine the procedure to reduce discomfort that is experienced by the animals. So we've actually had this committee operating for 10 years now, and we have looked at a variety of alternative methods, and many of these have now been adopted and are being used for by regulatory agencies for determining whether chemicals and products are safe or hazardous to people, animals, or the environment.
So, I mean, do you have an estimate? Is this going to eliminate hundreds of animals, thousands of animals, tens of thousands of animals from research?
Well, we estimate that it's had a fairly significant effect. Just one example is a test that's used to determine whether a chemical can be poisonous to people or children. It's called the acute oral toxicity test. When it originated early in the 20th century, it was standard to use up to 200 animals to conduct that test. By the 80s, that number was down to 25, and we recently reviewed and endorsed a method that's been adopted internationally now to make that determination that only uses about 6 to 9 animals. So, you know, there's a 70% reduction on average in the number of animals used for that particular test. And that is the most common toxicity test or safety test conducted in the world. So I think that's pretty significant.
Jonathan Wolf, has this kind of thing been taking place in the UK, this idea of replacing, using toxicological screens involving cells rather than living animals?
Yes. The idea, I have to say, was invented in the UK from Richard Ryder in the 1950s, and then it was ignored for about 20 years and has now become fashionable again. The three R's are, I think, very important, and there's no doubt that if we could really carry them forward, this would be the way of the future, I think. And the scientists I've spoken to have been enthusiastic, but what we have to realize is, particularly on the replacement end, it is limited. So we can make a distinction between safety testing and drug research. And although a certain amount of safety testing can be done using replacement techniques, cell cultures, and so on, it's very hard to see how you can test a drug on something less than a whole animal. So there are limits to the three R's, particularly on replacement.
We're talking this hour about animals in research, the ethics, the merits, and the possibilities for replacing them, I suppose. That would be one way of looking at it. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now we have a query from the people who are listening to this program on in Second Life on Science Friday Island. And we have a question from Mamphor Riptide, who says, theoretically, don't many researchers need to file petitions showing lack of alternative safety testing? Michael Kahn, is there a need to researchers to say this is why we must use animals in this particular project?
Absolutely, there is. Every protocol is reviewed according to the three R's. We try to reduce the number of animals used, to refine the technique so there's less pain and suffering, and ultimately to replace the animals with non-animal techniques. I think that's something we all agree on. Animal research is very costly and very difficult, and as new alternatives become available, I will be first in line to use them. I read an article by Dr. Wolf in which he noted that between the 70s and today, animal use has already been halved.
Dr. Wolf, is that the direction you think things are going in?
Well, I hope it is. I fear it might not be, because we live at a time when we're more and more concerned about chemicals and toxins and safety. And so we've had directives in the EU that a great deal more safety testing must be done. So at the same time as trying to reduce the number of animals in research, we have increasing numbers used for safety testing in some areas. But also, we have to remember that there are lots of other ways in which animals are used in scientific research, for example, in genetic modification. And so there's a need or a scientific need to create genetically mutated mice, say, for particular purposes. But this is very haphazard, and hundreds of thousands of mice will be bred without the correct mutation, and euthanized is the term. And what worries a lot of people, I think, is that huge loss of life, admittedly animal life, but the fundamental moral question is whether an animal life is less valuable than a human life. Now, it may be that it is, but we need to think, why is it? What are the reasons? What are the arguments?
All right, fair enough. I think we have time for one quick call before the break, and let's go to Rick in Phoenix, Arizona. Rick, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. A very interesting topic today. Just very briefly, I had polio in 1952, full paralysis of both legs, braces throughout the childhood, throughout my adulthood, and now suffer from post-polio muscular atrophy, where I'm losing whatever muscle tone I had gained through arduous efforts throughout my life. And if it hadn't been for salt growing the vaccine in the pancreas of Reese's, this scourge of mankind, which has been, there's even a cartouche of a pharaoh with the characteristic flail leg of the polio victim, if it hadn't been for Salk and other scientists working with animals to create this vaccine, millions of children would suffer the same fate that I suffer.
Right.
And that would end my comment, other than saying that the animal rights activists seem to be as ignorant of the scientific method as most Americans.
Oh, wow.
End of comment, gentlemen.
Okay, Rick, thank you very much for that call. Well, we're going to continue talking about the use of animals in research, the benefits and the ethics and the possibilities of replacement. So stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. We're talking about animals and research. My guests this hour are Michael Kahn. He's the Associate Director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center, Jonathan Wolfe, a philosophy professor at the University College London, and William Stokes. Dr. Stokes is at the National Interagency Center for the Evaluation of Alternative Toxicological Methods. It's a committee organized by the National Institutes of Health that helps look at using non-animal alternatives in the lab. And really what I wanted to do is ask each of you gentlemen, as we wind up this segment, to speak to the question of what's missing in the debate? I mean, William Stokes, has there been an aspect of the animal research debate that hasn't gotten enough attention, in your opinion, and that maybe that it's these that there are alternatives, but what's missing from the debate from your point of view?
Well, I'm a veterinarian by training, and I actually specialized in laboratory animal medicine. And I think it's really important, as Dr. Wolf pointed out, for the public to understand that animals are only used where they have to be used, and that their use has to be justified, that they must be used in the most humane way possible, and that the number of animals used can only be that number that's necessary for scientific validity, and that animals in the laboratory get exceedingly good care. They all have an attending veterinarian that's trained in laboratory animals. I think the other thing that's missing is there's not much emphasis given to the progress that's being made in both research and in the area of testing, where we're able to use non-animal methods and where those are having an impact on the animal research. We've made incredible advances in being able to grow different types of cells and organs within the body and culture. We've come up with improved computational approaches, including the new science of informatics, where we can integrate very complex biological information. And I think it's important for the public to be aware of this progress that is being made, and that's often not discussed.
Okay, Jonathan Wolfe, what's missing here that should be given more emphasis, in your opinion?
Well, I agree with everything that's just been said. I think there is a tremendous lack of knowledge. And I would just say one thing very briefly, which is that I think a lot of people who give money to charity, to medical charities, don't understand where that money goes. So if people make a donation to a heart charity or a cancer charity, they somehow think that the input is money and the output will be a cure, without thinking that that money is paying for laboratory experiments very often on animals. And I'm not saying this will change people's view, but it does seem to me important that people know what is happening to the money that they provide.
All right. Interesting point. Finally, Dr. Michael Kahn, go ahead with what's missing. You've written a book trying to call people's attention to this, what you call a silent war. What do you think is missing?
We're trying to get it on the public agenda. We want people to know that animals are treated well in research and that a great deal of good comes from research. The question I would end with is, does the possibility of a child having a normal lifetime weigh less than the abstract principle that we can't use animals in research?
Well, we'll leave that one hanging in the air, just as you phrased it. Thank you very much, all three of you gentlemen, for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Joe.
That was Michael Kahn. He's the Associate Director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center. He's also the co-author of a forthcoming book, The Animal Research War, from Palgrave Macmillan. We also spoke with Jonathan Wolfe, a philosophy professor at University College London, who helped write a 2005 bioethics report on animal experimentation, and also William Stokes. He's the director of the National Interagency Center for the Evaluation of Alternative Toxicological Methods, a committee organized by the National Institutes of Health that helps look at using non-animal alternatives in the laboratory.